This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, Congress averted a government shutdown with a last-minute basket when the president and the speaker of the House cut a deal to cut $38 billion in spending to fund the government through September. Congress is finalizing the details. What's certain is that this is no way the end of the budget battle.
And what did you think about those giant countdown clocks that the news stations run showing us how many seconds it was until the government would be shut down?
Edge of my chair.
But it is true. Congress is gearing up for more budget battles this week. And as you said, Mark, the budget deal that was struck late Friday night concerns the current year's budget. And that still needs full congressional approval this week. Then we have to move on to next year's budget.
Right. The short-term budget concerns are behind us. But the nation's long-term economic future is front and center. We talked last week about Republican Budget Committee Chair Paul Ryan's proposal for 2012. And his very controversial proposal to change Medicare essentially would privatize the entitlement program for the elderly. This is expected to be voted on the House at the end of this week. And we will see if there are any Democrats who are in support of that.
Well, Mark, I'm going to be really interested to see whether there's any of the hands off my Medicare howls by seniors that we heard a couple of summers ago when privatizing Medicare or just discussing Medicare in the context of health reform was on the table. And it's interesting to watch President Obama. Certainly, he is not mum on the topic of the deficit and the long-term debt. Like everyone else, he knows this long-term debt ceiling is incredibly important. And I think he also wants to tackle some changes to entitlement programs like Medicare and Medicaid, certainly not in the same way as Representative Ryan, but clearly very important strategic and policy issues for him.
Well, I think the tensions hopefully will calm down. It sounds like the president and the speaker have gotten a better relationship. And hopefully when the president talks to the country, he can start a conversation and hopefully we can have the public debate that President Obama provided in the Health Reform Act with any proposal that's coming out.
And one thing that's clear is you can't talk about a growing federal budget or federal deficit without talking about health, and you can't talk about health-related expenses without acknowledging the really important issue of the aging baby boomer population and issues of healthcare surrounding long-term care and long-term care expenses. And these are going to be front and center, I think, in the discussion about health reform in the coming year.
And on today's show, we're going to bring long-term care into the limelight. We're happy that Dr. Mary Jane Corrin, Vice President for the Pickering Commonwealth Fund Long-Term Quality Improvement Program, can join us today. She'll give us some perspective on issues surrounding long-term care that are driving this need for change, as well as some of the innovations and reform efforts that seem most promising.
We're delighted that Dr. Corrin is with us today on Conversations. And remember, no matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows on our website, chcradio.com. You can subscribe to iTunes to get the show downloaded or read a transcript of our shows at chcradio.com. If you're a social media aficionado, become a fan of Conversations on Healthcare on Facebook. And don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter, too.
And as always, if you have feedback, email us at chcradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Before we speak with Dr. Mary Jane Corrin, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, with Headline News.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. The Department of Health and Human Services unveiled a new plan to reduce health disparities. Some of the ideas outlined include working with states to increase the number of poor children who receive preventative dental care, using trained promotoras, the Spanish word for a trusted local, as community health workers, initiating new studies comparing which treatments work best for diabetes, asthma, arthritis, and heart disease in minority populations, and creating an online national registry of certified interpreters that doctors or hospitals can use for patients who don't speak English. HHS has yet to put a dollar figure on these pending projects, but said it plans to pay for them with money already in hand and not subject to Congress's ongoing budget battle. A grant program in the health reform law would give states, who are under pressure to cut Medicaid costs, incentives for Medicaid recipients who demonstrate a commitment to improving their health. The federal grant program is offering states $100 million to experiment with wellness incentives, like quitting smoking. States have until May 2nd to submit final proposals, and a number have already indicated interest. This week on Conversations, we're discussing long-term care, a word that can be interpreted several different ways when we talk about caring for seniors and those who need personal services on a continuing or reoccurring basis. Nursing homes, assisted living facilities, or home care services may come to mind. But what about a naturally occurring retirement community, or NORC as it's referred to? In New York City, this phenomenon is not all that new. In the late 1980s, Penn South, a high-rise co-op in Midtown Manhattan, became the first official NORC program in the United States. Today, the NORC model, which allows seniors to age in their homes and communities, is spreading throughout New York and across the entire country. I visited one NORC in northeastern Queens, New York. Like most American suburbs, Clearview Gardens was built after World War II to help fill the need for affordable housing. Low-rise brown brick housing units are spread out over 88 acres of quiet, tree-lined streets. Off to the side of one unit, a sign points people around back to the NORC program office and community rooms.
What ended up happening is people got older, and especially given the type of community this is, with geographical spread of it and the fact that there's no elevators, and between the spread of the community and the steps that they had to take, we got more and more people as they got older became isolated. And without the kids around to kind of pull people together either, the needs really, really grew.
That's Gary Babad. He directs the Clearview Assistance Program, a NORC that began in the late 1990s through the efforts of a group of seniors in the community who recognized the need for more support systems. By definition, a NORC is a demographic descriptor of a community or housing development where a large concentration of elders live. It's a community that wasn't built for seniors but now houses them. And a NORC program is the response to that. It's a model of care that offers a broad range of support for the residents of a NORC. A group of senior women who welcomed me in one of the two community spaces at Clearview rattled off a list of activities that could occupy their days, ranging from transportation services to local shopping to daily exercise classes and groups like knitting for charity.
I mean, there's so many. I can't think of all the programs we have.
Oh, and we have our Dear Abby program.
Oh, well,
that's about our Dear Abby.
Well, Dear Abby's just a handful of us. We decided, you know, the Dear Abby letters that they have. So we cut them out, and then we sit down, and we answer them always.
Every NORC program is unique because it's based on the individual community's wants and needs. However, the objective remains the same: to improve the quality of life for senior residents. Health, of course, factors in heavily. Karen Schwab directs older adult services at Samuel Field Y, one of the larger programs that oversees Clearview's NORC, as well as two others in the area. She says the support staff at Clearview, like Patty Clementi, the on-site nurse, make a huge difference in the health and well-being of the residents.
It's much easier engaging somebody who already knows about you. So when people already know Patty because they've already met her, and if, God forbid, they really need her as the NORC nurse, it's very easy to call somebody and say, can Patty come over? Because I already know who Patty is. And that is really so much part of what a NORC is. So we really work very hard at engaging people when they're well.
Starting in about 2002, Congress directed earmark spending to fund NORC programs in 25 different states across the country. This ultimately led to an increasing focus on prevention in NORC-funded programs. Freda Vladek is the director of the United Hospital Fund's Aging in Place initiative, which focuses on advancing the NORC model. She's also the founding director of the first NORC program in New York City at Penn South.
Because we had such a critical mass in New York, we started to look at that very issue of, so how are the NORC programs maximizing the health and well-being of seniors? It took us a little while to really develop a framework that permitted us to identify the health risks, develop some standards of care and practice, and then measure the progress in reducing those health risks.
The Health Indicators Project helped different NORCs identify themselves in terms of the population's health. It permitted each NORC program to pick an issue and decide as a community that they were going to focus on reducing the risk of that problem. Clearview chose to address falls risks because they figured it was going to be important to prevent them as the population grew older. Again, Gary Babad.
What we do with the health indicators is we look at a set of factors that have kind of determined to contribute to people's likelihood of falling. And Patty's probably the biggest part of that because a lot of it is looking at things like blood pressure. Patty will look at trigger drugs, things that, you know, might lead to a fall or drug interactions that might be dangerous for people.
In terms of cost, this model strays away from how healthcare is traditionally paid for, one hip fracture at a time, so to speak. Vladek says the NORC program model isn't tied to Medicare or Medicaid reimbursement because it's not the same as providing individualized medical care. Like most NORCs, Clearview is funded by a public-private partnership, receiving some funding from government grants and some from private donors. But staff, like Schwab, worry about sustainability amid so much budget tightening, especially, she says, when thinking about future demand.
This community, you'll have grandparents, parents, and grandchildren all living here. There have been children who moved back because of the supports. There are children that have moved back because they like growing up in the community.
To learn more about the NORC model, visit NORCblueprint.org. Let's turn now to our interview with Dr. Mary Jane Corrin from the Commonwealth Fund, who can tell us more about some other reform efforts that are underway to improve long-term care.
This is Conversations in Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Dr. Mary Jane Corrin, who leads the Picker Commonwealth Fund Long-Term Care Quality Improvement Program. Welcome, Dr. Corrin.
Thank you.
You know, advocates for long-term care have realized the need to reform this type of care, which, as you know, mainly serves senior citizens, but also the disabled and chronically ill adults who cannot care for themselves. What are the issues surrounding long-term care that are driving this demand for change?
Well, I think one of the things is that we have to realize that long-term care does not equal nursing homes, and that, in fact, there are a wide variety of supports and services that come under that umbrella term. So, for example, we have assisted living, we have adult foster care, daycare, and I think one of the problems is that people have resisted the idea of long-term care because they think it's just nursing homes. The other thing, and you pointed it out, was that long-term care is not just for the elderly. I believe something like 35 or 40% of all long-term care services are given to people under the age of 65. So this is an issue for everyone.
So Dr. Corrin, the Commonwealth Fund through the Long-Term Care Quality Improvement Program that you lead is very committed to reform and innovation of the delivery system for long-term care. And as you've just said, that's a much broader area than many people realize. You've identified several projects and practice models that have as their aim the improvement of the delivery of long-term care services. Maybe you could describe one or two that you think are the most promising in terms of creating and sustaining change and improvement.
Sure. One of our programs that we've supported now for the last several years has been a quality campaign for nursing homes. It's called Advancing Excellence, and people can go and look at the website. It's nhqualitycampaign.org, and we have sections in there for consumers, for healthcare workers, and also for the providers. And what we are doing is we are giving nursing homes, because it's nursing home directed, we're giving nursing homes the opportunity to voluntarily get better. And we've been really excited that we've been a partner with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid on this. And we have been able to show over the last 4 or 5 years that the nursing homes that participate in the campaign actually get better faster and improve more than nursing homes who are not in the campaign. And right now there are over 7,000 nursing homes that have participated in and joined Advancing Excellence. So that's one of, I think, our big wins. Another one, for example, is our Pioneer Network that we've helped to support that. And I had talked a little bit about trying to transform the care in nursing homes. And the Pioneer Network has really supported all different kinds of providers with information to enable them to really put the person in the center of care rather than, again, trying to make the person fit into the system in which they find themselves. So the Pioneer Network has really worked with policymakers. There's even a section in the healthcare reform law that calls for demonstrations to see how this kind of what we call culture change work, how it affects individuals in nursing homes, and also how it affects workers at nursing homes.
And as you mentioned, the Affordable Care Law, there are several provisions that support long-term care. Perhaps the most talked about is the CLASS Act, Community Living Assistance Service and Support. And as you know, that program would provide cash benefits to recipients that could be used for a variety of non-medical expenses, such as paying for home health aid or family member who provides care. Opponents are taking aim at the program over concerns that it won't be able to sustain itself financially. What's your perspective on the CLASS Act? Does it change things for the better?
I think that the CLASS Act is probably one of the most revolutionary pieces of legislation mm-hmm. that we've seen. People should not have to impoverish themselves in order to get long-term care. And just as you insure yourself against acute events when you're younger, you also should be insuring yourself against long-term care needs. We certainly know, as I said, almost 40% of people who need long-term care are under 65, so this is not just a problem of the elderly. And we also know that, for example, something like 1 in 5 people over the age of 65 are probably going to spend some time in a nursing home. So long-term care is probably going to be in your future. And what the CLASS Act does is it enables you to insure against that by enrolling in the program early on and sort of self-insuring yourself through that time period. We think this is incredibly important. It was very interesting. The SCAN Foundation did a poll of Americans right before the health care reform law was brought forward and found that 92% of Americans said they wanted improved coverage for care that would keep them out of nursing homes. And that's one of the things the CLASS Act does. So we know that there is widespread public support for this, and now what we need to do is to be sure people understand they need to enroll in it early.
I agree with you. There's support when people understand it, but we haven't heard people talk about it that much on the street, so we're really glad to put some attention on that today. You know, let me ask you, Dr. Corin, in addition to the financing of long-term care, there's other areas of great concern, as you said, certainly quality improvement, probably some regulatory issues. But I want to talk particularly about workforce development. You know, in the reform bill and in the literature generally, we talk a lot about shortages in primary care. But I would suspect that workforce development, recruitment, training, retention, both on the clinical level, such as geriatricians like yourself, but also on that frontline worker level with the elderly and with others in long-term care, is an area of real concern. Anything that you're working on there you see as promising and hopeful?
There's a lot going on in that area. You're probably familiar with the recent report that the Institute of Medicine did looking at the elder care workforce, recognizing, as you said, that as the baby boom generation ages, we are going to need more workers and we're going to need better trained workers in order to care for them. One of the things we know in long-term care is that it's what we call high touch, not high tech. And so quality is going to be predicated on the quality of the workers. And that goes whether or not you're a geriatrician or you're a nurse's aide in a nursing home. One of the things that we have recognized with the culture change that I talked about is that it is as much about helping workers do the job they want to do as it is about changing the environment or helping the residents. And there are several alliances that are working on this. There's the Elder Care Workforce Alliance that really is looking at all the levels, both professional and non-professional, trying to do this. And so we're really excited about what's happening. And also, if you think about it from an economic perspective, in some ways this is good because we're going to need an additional 3.5 million healthcare workers in the next 15 years. So it's a job opportunity.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Dr. Mary Jane Corrin, a long-term care expert at the Commonwealth Fund. Dr. Corrin, we like to follow what innovations are happening at the state level here on Conversations on Healthcare. And I'm sure there are a lot in this area. And, you know, we've been looking at the states as incubators for change, laboratories for change. So what do you see out in the states that we should be keeping an eye on?
One of the things that we're trying to do is we're trying to think about how we can use payment incentives to encourage nursing homes and other long-term care providers to really provide more, as we were saying, person-centered care. Colorado is testing some of this. A couple of other states are thinking about it. I know Ohio is looking at this. So we're really working closely with states to do just exactly what you said, to sort of test things, to incubate ideas, try new things. We have culture change coalitions in probably 25 or 30 states. So we know that this is a kind of thing that's happening. And one of the very encouraging things is that these are not just efforts that are happening by people within the state, but they are partnering with the agencies, the health department and the state Medicaid agencies, the ombudsman program. All of these state programs are actually coming together and participating with consumers to try to create a better system. And so it's pretty exciting.
Well, I'd like to jump off the comments on culture change and maybe talk about culture in a little bit different sense. You know, just such a great area of fascination for all of us, of just what a diverse country the United States is, how many cultures, how many countries of origin people here in the United States have. And that, of course, as people get older, continues right into the long-term care setting. At the Commonwealth Fund, where you've done so much work on looking at differences in culture and health status and disparities, is your center focusing on this sort of transformation that we'll see in the long-term care area as well as our increasingly diverse culture ages?
What we're trying to do is we're piloting a program right now in four states called the Critical Access Nursing Home Project. And it is a project that we saw the need for based on some of the research that Dr. Vince Moore at Brown University was doing that really highlighted the disparities in care for people utilizing usually inner city nursing homes. And very often these were people who were poor, that were on Medicaid, or were members of a minority ethnic group. So we really saw this as something that needed to be addressed. So what we have done is we've created networks within the state to come together and really try to work closely with the nursing homes, a couple of nursing homes in the inner cities, to see if we can improve their quality. And so far, we're having some really good effects. We're not finished with the project yet, but I think that it is addressing an issue that we know is there. And so far, there haven't been a lot of ideas out there about how to fix it.
Dr. Corrin, speaking of ideas, we like to ask all of our guests this question. When you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovation, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
I think one of the really innovative ideas that we're seeing right now is a recognition that no single provider group can fix things, that in a sense, it takes a community to fix it.
Today, we've been speaking with Dr. Mary Jane Corrin, who leads the Picker Commonwealth Fund Long-Term Care Quality Improvement Program. Dr. Corrin, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea focuses on mobile applications that are helping patients better manage their pain symptoms and communicate their pain with caregivers and providers more effectively. Roughly 9,000 health-related applications are currently available across mobile platforms, making it difficult for consumers to choose among the most effective. Pain Care, developed by Ringful Health, has gained recognition since winning a Project Health Design Award. This award is part of a larger national program from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation that designs next-generation personal health record systems. The app provides patients with an electronic pain journal to record their daily symptoms. With pain, triggers, and medications, users indicate pain levels by touching a frowning or smiling face, as well as locations, durations, characteristics, mood, and triggers. This data can then be shared instantly with a provider so that they can treat the patient better, as well as measure progress. The designers of Pain Care based the app on similar personal health application that was tested at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. The research team received input from focus groups on content, function, and design, and then tested a working prototype. User-friendly applications that are helping patients better manage their symptoms, medications, and communications with caregivers and providers. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.